I'm Alex.
And I'm Matt, and welcome back to the show. Our guest is Andrew Abbott, a professor at the University of Chicago's Sociology Department. He studied at Harvard and the University of Chicago for his undergraduate and graduate degrees, and also taught for 13 years at Rutgers University. He is well known for his theoretical analysis of professions and their development, and is the author of 6 books and some 70 articles and chapters.
So firstly this week, apologies for the absence. I have been slightly under the weather, but we are back now, and hopefully we're going to be back on a more regular schedule. And we wanted to make sure we got someone really good this week to make up for the absence.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the entirety of recording this. I always enjoy our shows, but this was a militant and crystal clear defense of knowledge, of researching, of the not necessarily old school, but just a very thorough and academic way to conduct knowledge, and the importance of reading and writing and memorization. And the basis for all of that was a book he wrote recently called Digital Paper. Alex and I both, I guess we both highlighted up like half of it.
Probably both, illicitly on our Kindle devices, which he has problems with, as you will hear in the discussion.
Yeah, exactly. You and I were just talking about this after the show. He just strikes me as the kind of guy you want to hang out with. He is very well reasoned and very kind of staunch in his defense of why essentially internet based research or even digitally based research is maybe not quite up to par versus print, and that the quality of reading and writing and research overall may be on the decline. And he gives some very, very interesting thoughts as to why he thinks that.
And definitely if you are a knowledge worker, researcher, writer of some sort, I definitely recommend giving the book a read. It's called Digital Paper, and it had all sorts of things which I hadn't really thought of, mainly relating to library work and working with paper and indexes and all sorts of things like that.
The one thing I'll say is it just made me not want to be stupid. We were recording it at 1 hour, and Alex and I had our little communications going on the side, and we just decided to let it roll, and we pushed straight through. And but it's great. It's well-reasoned arguments, and I think everybody will really enjoy it. Dr. Abbott, thank you so much for joining us today. I thought we'd start off with a kind of think again moment, and this is a graph from your book, Digital Paper, Manual for Research and Writing, which Alex and I are big fans of. And in here, you have some very strong language about the so-called revolution in research. And you write here, you may have heard from some people that there's a revolution in research and that it's easier than ever before. I don't need to tell you that this is nonsense. You know from firsthand experience that research is confusing and daunting, as indeed it always has been. We are no closer to a revolutionary improvement in library-based and found data knowledge than we were 30 years ago. More likely the reverse. The new tools, in fact, make it harder than ever for students to learn the disciplines of research, mainly through sheer overload. I was wondering if we could discuss that thought for a moment. It comes across very strongly in your book, but I think it flies in the face of what a lot of people like to think. Was there a specific moment in your kind of research career, initially with the internet or later on, that made you come to this?
No, I think the way to understand how I come to this stuff is that, I've worked with computational methods since the early 1980s. So the bottom line is that I have a lot of kind of prior experience with using search algorithms, computational approaches to data reduction, that kind of thing. It's relatively unusual in sociology. Historically, methods like scaling and clustering that are now considered data mining were really not very popular in the social behavioral sciences other than in psychology. at least in the U.S. You know, elsewhere in France, for example, correspondence analysis is made popular by Bourdieu. But in any case, so I've had a lot of experience with methods for data reduction, for dealing with large data sets, with computational methods that goes back to the early 1980s. What that means is that I have a real sense of what you can and cannot do with techniques like clustering and connection and scaling and so on, which are designed to do data reduction in very high dimension, high, large state space data structures. And so, you know, I have a sense of what you can do and what you can't do. And that's sort of my own personal experience. As far as the students I'm teaching are concerned, I know that the students I teach in my courses on library research are just completely overwhelmed by the amount of stuff that's available to them on the internet. And they're particularly overwhelmed because they don't have any kinds of clues about how to make judgments of quality. They have often a certain kind of dislike for strict quality measures. And they don't have what all of my generation had, which is a real sense of, you know, the strength and quality of bibliographical tools, because in reality, in the research world of 40 years ago, indexing was very expensive, and so very little of it was done, and because very little of it was done, it tended to be extremely high quality. Now mm-hmm. we do a huge amount of indexing using keywords. It's not very high quality. It finds lots and lots of junk. It just gives you the basic list that everybody has an experience from. Google and everything else has a big, long list of stuff of which you're interested in about half of 1%.
Right.
So the notion of being completely overwhelmed by the stuff that's in front of you, that's something I see in the personal experience of my students, but it's something that I have a sort of broader sense of because I actually know something about how data reduction works on a theoretical basis.
Right. This is actually a common theme of more than a few guests we've had on this show, is this lack of understanding of even the availability of research tools, let alone how to use them properly. Why do you think this issue with your students is so endemic? And are people, you know, are people at least aware of this, that we continually turn out students who are really unfamiliar with research tools, how to use them, or how to essentially get the most out of them?
I think that deep down, this is one of those things that happens, you know, in our world because of changes in another world. And the place where the change has happened is in high schools and other secondary forms of secondary education. Students used to come to college with having had the experience of using their high school library. They understood what an index was. They used the indexes in the backs of books, which in those days were real indexes, not keyword indexes. And just parenthetically, one of the great shocks of my life was when I realized that most of my students actually assumed that the indexes in the backs of older books were keyword indexes that had been compiled by hand. it is the case that most of our college students believe that. So the point is that my generation, perhaps your generation, we learned this stuff automatically in high school or in our local town library on an experience that we had with the librarian floundering around doing some kind of research paper. Obviously, you know, high school teachers, secondary school teachers are now under immense pressures of production, and it's not at all surprising that they have basically sent students to the internet to discover things. And now that the students are actually on the internet before they are in congregate schooling, in terms of the life course, they're on the internet by the time they're three or four, you know, students have begun, they come into the world thinking that the internet is kind of the model of knowledge. That's what it is. Whereas for my generation, presumably for yours, students come into the world, they're prepared by print. Of course, we read plenty of junk print. I mean, don't get me wrong. obviously we read lots of trash magazines and comic books and all that other stuff, but we had a notion that, oh yeah, when it's a serious paper, I have to go to the library and maybe I'll ask the librarian something and I'll learn about these indexes and I'll learn about the idea of indexing and so on. And we kind of picked that up and brought it to college with us. The students today don't have that, but what they do have is a great facility with the internet. And it's easy for them because one of the things the internet does is it can accidentally enable you to find something very detailed right in the middle of something that's really unbelievably good. When older people hear someone say, oh, well, I've seen so-and-so, and it's one of those, you know, super good sources, the older person assumes, oh, you never would have found that if you didn't know all this other stuff as well. Whereas, in fact, in the new world, you can kind of accidentally discover something like that. You don't really know that it's all that great because you don't have a notion of how to organize things into that. But, you know, it does persuade the older person that, oh, you must really know all this stuff and know how to find things. But in fact, when you sit down with students, even students who you think actually know this stuff well, it turns out that they have very little idea how to find stuff systematically. And furthermore, the central thing is they don't know how to find high-quality stuff. And their main, as I say several times in the book, the main problem of students today is not that they can't find enough stuff, it's that they can find far too much stuff. And most of what they find is of low quality, so you have to teach them how to discover what's the high-quality stuff.
Speaking of libraries, you know, obviously in the course of your lifetime and mine, libraries have gone from something sacrosanct almost to almost a kind of institution where people wonder what their purpose is anymore, whether this is inspired by the kind of Googles of the world or not. What role do you see libraries, as in physical libraries, playing in 2015 and going forward? Do you see any change to how they might be used, or in an increasingly kind of globalized world? Do you see different ways in which we might be accessing libraries?
Well, I think that, you know, and there are two kinds of predictions to make here. One is what is going to happen. And the other is what ought to happen. What is going to happen is, of course, that most of these buildings are probably going to be repurposed, the same way most churches are being repurposed in the West these days. That's because administrators have space problems, and they see the library as a waste of space.
Right.
That's what's going to happen to the library, not at the top of the research system, but throughout the rest of the system. It has happened to some quite major libraries in major American universities, in part because the library is generally a gigantic building in the middle of campus, which could be repurposed in a way to solve a lot of people's space problems. So the University of Minnesota is a classic example. They built a new research library outside the center of campus, across the Mississippi River on the West Campus. And they took the original main library, gutted the building, and turned it into a grand, you know, student research center or student something or other center. Now, you know, that is what's going to happen to a lot of places. The big argument against that is an argument that was central to our building a new facility, an add-on to our already enormous library as a large-scale high-density depository. And that's the following set of numbers. I looked at the circulation statistics for our mini library, 4.5 million items, over a period of 8 years. And I discovered, much to my surprise and much to everyone else's surprise, that fully 21% of the library had been taken out at some point in those 8 years.
Wow.
Interesting.
21% of, it's a lot of books. And it's a lot of very strange and weird books. And in fact, of those things that have been taken out, fully half, about 10% of the total, have been taken out only once. So that's about 450,000, 500,000 items. Now, you know that an item that was taken out only once was probably an esoteric piece of research material that, you know, some researcher needed for a a project he or she was doing. And you might say, well, why the hell should we store those things on campus? We could store them off campus and the person could get it a day from now. Well, here's why that argument is wrong. If you look at 450,000 items and you divide it by the number of days there are in 8 years, what you're going to find out is that about 150 times a day, a faculty member or researcher found on the shelf when he or she needed it, a book. Mm-hmm. That's the argument that persuaded the trustees that it was worthwhile to have this large building containing huge amounts of books right in the center of campus because they don't want their researchers to have to wait till tomorrow to get stuff.
Right.
And the central problem, the reason that this argument doesn't make sense to many of the young people is that they don't actually know about chained research where you're just bouncing from source to source to thing to thing. They don't realize that that's possible because nobody's ever instructed them in how to use the library. And of course, you know, at first glance, this notion, well, the book was needed only once in 8 years. Why should we have it on the shelf? Well, the answer is because maybe that book wasn't needed, but some book was needed. And if, you know, 150 times a day, your researchers are finding stuff that they need at that moment, you know, you're not going to shut that down. It's like telling the physics department, you're not going to let them go in their laboratory until tomorrow. It's kind of stupid.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with everything you're saying. Then again, I also kind of remember back when I was an undergraduate student, and you know, they would tell you at kind of a university initiation that the library was holding a kind of initiation day, and students could go along and you know, meet some of the librarians and find out how it all worked. I think I went, but you know, there were maybe, you know, 15 students who showed up out of, I don't know, 1,000 people or so on who joined that year. Is it just a question of kind of teaching people how to use libraries? Is it a question of teaching them why it's important to research in this way?
I think it's both of those things. And I think the difficulty is that many of our colleagues don't realize that this is a moment at which it's use it or lose it. They have to start teaching these things and start really introducing their students to this kind of work, or the libraries are simply going to get taken away. So my bet when I wrote the original memos proposing this new system at Chicago, I bet that by this time there would exist maybe 10 major research libraries that still had everything on site in one place. In reality, the number is even less than that. My son is a graduate student at Yale, and he has to wait a day to get, you know, bread and butter monographs right in the center of his current discipline. It's like everything else in the universities, it's a matter of budgets. And I think, you know, essentially our colleagues have to recognize that if they want this kind of research to last, they are going to have to teach students how to do it and teach them why it's so good. And the difficulty with that, in a certain sense, is that for those of us who know what we're doing, the internet's absolutely wonderful. It enables us to do stuff we've never been able to do before. It enables us to find these amazing long shots. It's astounding. And so we don't realize that at the same time, it's completely corrupt as a first introduction to how to function in research. So we're not seeing I feel my colleagues are not seeing the desperate nature of the case. That's why I wrote the book. I think what's actually going to happen is that the vast majority of universities are basically going to deaccession large portions of their libraries. It will become defined as a, you know, online natural monopoly, that something like HathiTrust or will exist as a basic general repository. Of course, the main problem with that is that nobody actually reads anything on the net. I think the data are that people read up to 6 or 7 pages, but they don't tend to read anything that's longer than that. you know, fighting against that argument, however, is also the notion that reading itself is clearly in rapid decline, both in our students and, in fact, among our colleagues. You can see that by looking at the number of percentage of all citations that have page numbers on them. I did this in the case of, for example, Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and showed that when the book first came out, about 17% or 17% of the references to it in the literature had page numbers. So it'd be not just Kuhn 1970, but Kuhn 1970, page 26.
Right.
Now that number is down to about 2 or 3%, and it's very clear that the vast majority of people who are citing Kuhn have actually probably never read the book. I did a study of a few years ago of all the people who had cited my book on professions in the year 2009 with about 100 people. And it was very clear that a substantial number of those, up to maybe half, had really failed to understand what the basic point was of the book. So it's clear that reading is in some kind of a crisis at this point. I mean, for example, look, I just sent in the manuscript of my latest book, a book called Processual Sociology, that's making a sort of pulling together a lot of my central theoretical arguments from a lifetime. And the University of Chicago Press, which is a wonderful press, still sends me a form about abstracts and keywords, and they want a 200-word abstract of this book. Well, of course, you know, I said there is no two. My abstract is, you must read this book. If I had wanted to write only 200 words, I would have written only 200 words. End of abstract. But, you know, that's the point. We're moving to a world in which people think that everything can be abstracted, which is kind of this notion of a commodity form of knowledge. I mean, essentially, the Marxist analysis applies very, very clearly to what's happening to knowledge right now. It's being turned into commodities. It's being assumed that all there is in knowledge is commodity. And so this notion that you can get the point and extract the point becomes central to the way people think that knowledge works. Well, that isn't the way knowledge works. And we're actually, of course, in a much bigger crisis than the one we're talking about here about libraries. We're actually at a point in which the students who are coming up into our classes now are not kids who really understand how knowledge works. That, too, is a problem of the internet, because the internet teaches you that to know something is to know an address. That's just experientially the message of the internet. Everything you want to know is somewhere. You just have to find out where that somewhere is. Well, of course, that's not what knowing is. Knowing is not knowing an address. It's something else. It's putting things together. It's assembling things. It's making a new idea in your own head. The internet doesn't teach you that. The internet teaches you you can find anything. And it teaches you, in a sense, to think of knowledge as a big bunch of commodities. And your aim is to put those commodities in a pile. Now, in part, the students are being taught this by the way they're taught how to write. Because the way they learn how to write, again, because of the pressure on secondary school teachers, is to go through a text, select out the quotes that they want from the text, and then lard in between the quotes sentences of interpretation. So if you ask students, you interview them, how do you write a paper? You'll discover a huge number of them do this. You assign a paper on Hobbes. They read the 3 or 10 or whatever chapters of Hobbes. They underline the sentences that they think were the important ones. They then put them in a list and a file, and they just have Hobbes said so-and-so, and then they write a paragraph of stuff that kind of reacts to that, and then Hobbes also says blah, blah, and then they respond to that. It's bizarre. They have no idea that they need to comprehend Hobbes's argument and then respond to the argument, not to the bits of which it's made. But if you ask them, give me Hobbes's argument, summarize Hobbes's argument, they will give you a list of bullet points. That's because they've been in classes where people have presented arguments as lists of bullet points. So in many ways, you know, the teachers are to blame. But the whole concept of knowledge, as it was understood certainly by the middle 20th century, is just under very serious attack right now. And it's hard to see how that's actually going to be changed much. The reason for that is this, obviously, the vendors, Google and these other people, there's a huge amount of money to be made from higher education. It's a $1 trillion budget item in the United States, and the capitalists didn't think they were getting their chunk of it. So that's what's happening.
Yeah,
Go ahead. I was about to say, you know, that people have often accused me, why didn't you become a Marxist? Well, this is finally doing it to me.
you just said a lot of things. Alex and I are getting a little bit depressed, I would guess. But I was wondering, you touched on our next question right there, which is to wonder what role do teachers and your colleagues themselves play in this? You said a little bit, but assuming this kind of very basic view where students will take the path of least resistance, I mean, is this at least partially the problems? You mentioned the strains that teachers are under of not demanding higher quality work, and irregardless of that, could you start demanding higher quality work, or do you feel like you're just alone, the one-off professor kind of doing that there's no institutional way in, let's even just say, academia or in high school to address this?
Well, I think, you know, institutionally we could address these kinds of things. I think, you know, I don't think that, I think my own role in a certain sense is as a lone scholar. And, you know, I can write a book digital paper because I know both sides of the fence. I know enough computationalism to be able to demolish the computation arguments, but I'm, you know, also know how to do library research. And I think, you know, the role for people like me is to actually say what is going on, to focus on the nature of the phenomenon. In this case, you know, I wrote the manual first. In fact, I've written two manuals on how to think, this one and Methods of Discovery as well. And that's because teaching is the most important place to start. But then I'm also writing a book on the future of knowledge. And that's where you're hearing this speech come out. Well, that's, you know, it's a speech I've been working up for quite a while. So I think there's certainly a role for somebody like me is to say what is actually going on. As far as, you know, how is that going to spread? It'd be interesting to see how it spreads. One way it could end up spreading is by this becoming a kind of counter movement among elite educational institutions, in which there actually are the resources to pay people to teach, students. Although the difficulty is in the elite institutions, they're all being managed by these bean counters who are counting citations, which are obviously a pile of crap anyway. So, you know, there is the problem. You basically have to have institutions which are willing to just thumb their noses at this entire external management stuff, from U.S. News and World Report to these, you know, world university rankings. And it's pretty hard to do that. You know, the capitalists know how to impose discipline on systems, and they're doing that by creating all these phony baloney rating systems, which don't rate anything, but which become, you know, rating schemes to which administrators feel they are hostage. So I think that, you know, one possibility is this becomes a radical movement among people who are actually believe in knowledge and intelligence and keep it going until a more auspicious moment. Another possibility is for a few institutions to take it up and to become the sort of, you know, St. John University of their time, where students will go and actually get a real education. But, you know, a lot of this is also caught up in the fact that the students feel they're scared of the labor force and what's going to happen to them. They've become very professionalized themselves. And it may be the case that the kind of approach to knowledge and openness to knowledge that I'm talking about as an ideal was in fact something that existed only for the most privileged people in the mid and late 20th century, because they were, in a sense, they had kind of guaranteed career futures ahead of them, and they could afford to spend 4 years actually what we call getting an education, because the job world was so auspicious that things would be fine. You know, they now don't think they have that kind of auspicious world ahead of them, and so they're obsessed with getting a certain kind of education that will provide advancement in the employment world you know, so they're busy. They spend all their college years trying to get internships. You know, they, of course, also all want to go abroad. Although in the United States, the main reason for wanting to try to go abroad is that this is the only country in the world with a 21-year-old age for alcohol. And so, you know, if you walk through the street to Paris at 11 o'clock on a May evening, you're going to walk by the River Seine and see thousands of American college students down there on the banks getting completely smashed. And if you interview students, you know, after a couple of years after they're out of college, they'll be quite frank about the fact that going abroad is just a scam. So, mm-hmm. It's pretty depressing. but, you know, if it's, doesn't matter if it's depressing, your aim, you know, what you still are called upon to do is to identify what it is that we do that is really good and great, how it has to be done, and lay that out there. Because a lot of the defense made of, you know, these older forms of building knowledge are just sort of knee-jerk, oh, it's stupid, oh, whatever, but, you know, I'm going to use the internet or whatever. You can't do that. You have to, you know, look at it and figure out exactly why is it that what we do is better knowledge. One of the things that really struck me most in having these battles over the last 10 years is that, you know, I knew perfectly well that, you know, being able to do library research faster is not necessarily going to improve it. It's not as if there's a perfect answer to the meaning of the novel Moby Dick out there, and if we can only go faster, we'll find it faster. Right. You know that that's not true, but the question is, do we actually have judgments of what is better knowledge, for example? So, you know, I decided to research that a few years ago, and my means of researching it was to look at complaints about the research assessment exercise in Great Britain. It turns out that in 2001, after the RAE, they had a commission of inquiry to look at problems in the RAE, and they asked, among other things, in their questions, you know, that they put out for response, what is excellent research? And so I read all of those responses. In fact, I used a computerized technique to analyze them. So I read all these responses saying, what is excellence? Excellence is blah, blah, excellence is blah, blah, blah. Well, I knew that if I read those documents, my own sense of the word excellence would deform. It would change the way I read them. So I used an electronic program and simply global substituted the word IT, for excellence. And then I tried to infer from the ways they had talked about it what they actually meant by excellence in research.
Right.
And I did this for all disciplines. And unfortunately, the paper is published in a very obscure place, but I think it's on my website. And it turns out that excellent research, you know three things about it. The first of all is you can't measure it. The only people who believe excellent research can be measured are the statisticians, not surprisingly. Second thing is nobody can recognize it but us, i.e. the discipline. So only people, you know, the public doesn't know anything about what's a good performance of Shakespeare. We know what is a good performance of Shakespeare. Similarly, the public doesn't know what is good physics. We know what's good physics. And then the third thing is, it's new. So that's it. It's basically something that can't be measured that we recognize that's new. That's the grand total of what people told the RAE board is really excellence in research. Now, that's pretty bad. You know, we need to be able to say something more profound than that. And so I've actually focused in a number of talks I've given recently on trying to come up with actual ideals for knowledge in disciplines which are not cumulative. Basically, most of the humanities and social sciences are not cumulative. So, you know, it's easy to say what's you know, best in physics or chemistry or something like that. They have a project. Although, interestingly enough, they didn't talk about it that way in their responses to the RAE. But, you know, at least I think of them as cumulative. But in a science, disciplines which are not cumulative, much harder to think of an ideal for good knowledge. And if you don't have an ideal, you don't really have a basis to argue with the idiots from Google. You have to be able to say Google is worse because X. Well, if you don't have a criterion for good research, good knowledge, you don't have any real basis on which to respond to them.
Right. I have to say it's refreshing may be the wrong word, but it's refreshing in an odd way to hear your very crystal clear thinking on this. I don't think many people hear from the critics of our current internet, you know, kind of based approach, internet-based research approach. It has a lot of supporters, and you know, of the three criteria you just said, it's usually backed simply because it's new, and critics are often derided as simply, you know, anti-progress. But what I'm really interested in is that you've established you know, a baseline, so to speak, that's beyond reproof, that shows that this approach is in fact leading down the road of not educating people properly. Is that safe to say?
Well, I think it's, I mean, I think you can say that the undergraduates, even the really smart undergraduates, do not have a certain class of skills of thinking that I'm pretty sure we had in our day. Now, I don't think we had them because we were wonderful and tried work much harder than they do and all this other kind of stuff. I think, as I said, much of it came to us passively because we all grew up in print. We swam in print all the time. And, you know, today's kids swim in images all the time. Today's kids can function much, much faster on image-driven stuff. They're much better with graphical user interfaces and this kind of stuff than I would be. But, you know, it's not the case at this point that there's any way to prove the fundamental theorem of the calculus using a graphical user interface. No, to do that, you have to have explicitly defined symbols and you have to array things in a discursive manner. At present, print and argument of the kind that we think of, you know, having to do with you know, set theory or something like that, formal logic, at present, you know, those kinds of tight discursive arguments are simply not doable through images. And what's really happening, the whole society is moving towards images. My favorite example of this is the example of the fact that basically, when you think about handheld devices and smartphones and so on, and all these different icons, we're essentially reinventing Chinese. We're reinventing a pictographic language. Now, you know, Chinese is a great language. You can write great poetry in it and stuff, but there are certain kinds of things that are very difficult to do in it. And one of those things is explicitly, rigorously defined, long discursive arguments of a certain kind, precisely because the pictographic approach to language is so powerfully associative and so powerfully reliant on association. So it's kind of amusing that the dominance of images is such that, you know, at a time when character use, for example, in Japan is rapidly in decline, I don't know actually about China, but everyone kind of agrees that alphabetic languages are in many ways more diverse, more cross, multiply functional than pictographic ones are. But in fact, the internet is now moving us rapidly back towards Chinese as a language. Very interesting. You know, I think that, it is the case that, you know, the young people, because of their immersion in this world of images, there are certain kinds of reasoning skills they don't have. And, you know, of course, those of us who know how to lie with pictures, which is certainly every advertiser in the world, you know that images, it's very easy to show people images that will make them believe things that, in fact, we know the numbers don't justify. You know, the most obvious, example of that is that all these programs are designed to scale any graph in such a way that, you know, a curve will look like it has a rise in it or a fall. In other words, so that the curve will be not isolated in the middle of a huge scale from 0 to 100, but it'll be made to look as if there's a lot of action in it by moving in the ranges. All these programs are designed to do that. So we have students coming for interviewing for jobs in our department, and they'll say, well, you see, there are these major effects. And you look at it, you say, that's not a major effect. There's no substantive effect there at all. If you had that displayed in real scales, this would be nothing.
But, you know, literally, these are people who are getting PhDs and going on the market for jobs, and they haven't seen that they need to do that. And that's, you know, it's because they have grown up in this world of images and haven't sort of learned the dangers of it. So, you know, it's great. Young people have their, young teachers have their work cut out for them. What a great thing they have. They can teach all this great stuff that people have forgotten.
At what point then is, despite these kind of problems that you were just outlining, at what point is technology, and whether we mean the internet or a piece of software to, or kind of ways to access databases, let's say, at what point is this technology at its most useful in terms of research?
I think the reality is that's going to be established over a period of time that's much longer than my life or your life even. So, I mean, you know, the thing to do is, of course, is to go back and study the impact of the book on knowledge in the West. And it's very clear that the rise of movable type and the rise of the book as something that could be owned by lots of people made an enormous change over hundreds of years in the way knowing occurred. The biggest change was the importance of memory went down. You no longer had to remember the whole damn Bible because you could just pull it out. And here was the thing, and you could say, yeah, it was kind of on the right-hand side of a page about halfway through Ezekiel. You know, if you have to remember the entire Bible in your head, the way, for example, lots of Quran scholars would, you know, the first thing they do is to memorize the entire Quran. That leads to a certain kind of knowledge culture, a certain form of knowledge. And when the book, the movable type and the broad availability of books came to the West in the 15th century, you know, you started to see a decline in the centrality and importance of memory. You, for example, also started to see a decline in the importance of letters as a mode of scholarship, writing letters to other people. So you can think of a scholar like Henri Peresque, whom most people have never heard of, even though, of course, heard of Montaigne and other people like that. Why? Well, Montaigne wrote books, but Peresque, who was his contemporary, did not. Peresque wrote about 100,000 letters, and his letters constitute a whole sort of universe of scholarship. But, you know, after that period, we don't recognize that as a mode of knowing, to be somebody who's in correspondence with lots and lots of people. We believe in big treatises. But it takes hundreds of years for the sort of larger implications of something, a change like the rise of movable type and the book, it takes hundreds of years for that to work itself out. And the same thing is going to be true with the current move to images. It's quite possible that, you know, 100 years from now or 200 years from now, if the world still exists, you know, they will have invented forms of very high quality knowing and knowledge that are based on purely on images. There are people who will strive to do that, who will work at doing that. And so that's what will happen. They'll discover all this quality stuff. You know, it'll come back. They may even invent a great combination of discursive and pictographic images that will be much better than anything we do now. I don't know, but that's stuff that's going to happen over a very long time. And, you know, the short run history of this stuff is going to be driven deep down by the capitalists. I mean, they've figured out a way to turn what was the great common property of scholarship, all these books sitting around in all these libraries, they have figured out by democratizing and then monopolizing access, they've figured out a way to charge everybody money for it. It's just really fascinating. So once again, the essence of capitalism is to take a common resource, package it up as property, and then sell it. It's just fascinating.
I'm wondering if you could give a defense, just pick one, of a situation that a graduate student or a researcher may find themselves in today, where it is hands down, unequivocally, the best option to go with a low-tech approach to research. Is there anything that springs to mind for you there?
Well, the most obvious one is, you know, understanding what a book has to say. So suppose I have a student and I have two students and I'm basically give one of them an electronic copy of the book and the other one, this is, you know, some form of scholarly book. I give one person an electronic copy, I give the other person a paper copy, and I give them 10 minutes to figure out what the book says, or 5 minutes to figure out what the book says. Absolutely no question that the person with a physical artifact is going to have 10 times as good a knowledge of the book. There's absolutely no way. How fast is the refresh time of changing pages? It's about a 20th of a second to turn a page, much faster than a web page will come up. It's just, you know, they've tried to create these, you know, book mimicking things where you can push the pages and stuff like this. It's just not the case. You know, with a physical artifact, you can just get through the thing much faster. So there's absolutely no question that that's better. And of course, when the physical artifact is on the shelf and immediately adjacent to a whole bunch of other things about the same thing, the comparison is just night and day. You know, so if somebody goes to a shelf in my library, a big, massive research library, and pulls stuff off the shelf and fiddles around with it for 20 minutes, that person is going to know 100 times as much as somebody who does the same thing on the internet. It's just no comparison.
Right. I'm wondering if you can explore that for a second. You write in your book, Digital Paper, a fair bit about the importance of browsing and you just mentioned it there again about sort of looking across a wide body of material. Is our ability to browse also kind of another casualty of the modern era?
Well, the central problem with the browsing is that, as I say in the book a lot, you know, browsing is completely dependent on, browsing is an associative technique. Browsing happens because you look at a page and in internet terms, it's all blue. Like it's all hyperlinks. But the things that it's hyperlinks to are in your head. So in fact, the fact that I can read, I don't know, some page of Hobbes or other, and it's all blue to me, that's because I know a lot of stuff about, you know, medieval law or whatever. One of the difficulties about the way the kids kind of approach the world today is that they don't think they need to know a lot. They don't believe in memorization. But memorization, although, you know, I was saying before, you don't need to memorize the whole of the Bible. But you need to like know what the important names are, something like that, because if you know that stuff, then the page of anything you read about the Bible will turn blue. You'll say, you won't necessarily know what's on the other end of the hyperlink, but you know it's a hyperlink to something. So the point is, you have to, in order to browse, you have to have a fair amount of stuff in your head already. And that's something that, you know, students gradually discover over a project. They don't actually discover that that's true. They don't verbalize it, but they experientially discover that it gets easier and easier for them to do browsing as they've been in a project for a longer and longer time, because they simply more stuff in their head so they can recognize, oh, that's a road I should go down. So I think the issue with browsing is a casualty, mainly because students don't realize that one of the things you have to do very early in a project is to just do a lot of background reading and a fair amount of memorization to just kind of get the stuff into your head so that as you read, you'll recognize important names and important things and important people and all that other kind of stuff. It's just a part, it's one of the basic tools of associative thinking.
So are you an advocate then for some of the kind of more formal kind of memorization, such as maybe would have been was far more commonplace, several hundred years ago, where people were really memorizing things.
Well, that gets us to a whole different thing. That gets us to a whole different issue. So in a project, you need to do memorization early because in order to make your browsing really work for you. That's in a sense different from saying, why were people memorizing things in education, 150 years ago? Because that's it's about a different thing. And I'll come to that in a sec. So I think that in the case of doing a particular project, you need to do memorization early. You know, if you're working on a historical period, you need to basically master the history in it. If you're going to write a paper about, I don't know, the rise of the Chicago School. I had lunch with somebody who's writing a paper about the Chicago School of Sociology and its discussions of women's issues at the turn of the 20th century. But if you're going to do that, you have to kind of know the background of 20th century history, early 20th century history in the U.S., just so that you'll recognize when they mention progressivism or they mention problems of with the steelworkers and union issues and so on. You have something that attaches to. In other words, you have to have a kind of contextual knowledge for the project. Now, when people were memorizing things 150 years ago, things are much more likely to memorize this. You know, they're all reading greats at Oxford and reading classical works in their original languages and all this kind of stuff. So how does that work? Well, I mean, or what's the importance of that? Well, the importance of that, you know, there were two theories. One piece is the sort of jungle gym theory that, hey, if you can master Latin and Greek, you can master anything. They're difficult languages, and, you know, if one of the things is you're going to fit for the service, the Indian civil service exam, and you're going to go to India, you know, chances are in India you're going to have to learn two or three languages that are easily as difficult as Latin and Greek. Of course, they had a big language school in India. And so in a certain sense, you know, there was a way in which the notion was learning Latin and Greek at college was simply a kind of an exercise that showed that exercised your mind. Same thing for, you know, math, if you happen to read, you know, let's say for the math tripos at Cambridge. Now, the other thing that's important about that kind of memorization is that it provides what we can call a canon. And, you know, you can have different thoughts about a canon, but recently, I wrote a big paper on the centrality of excess and how the central problem in life is too much of stuff, not too little. And I'm making the argument now that that's a general problem in social life, not just a problem in libraries. Although, obviously, in my own research trajectory, it's because the great problem in libraries is not scarcity, it's overload. Yeah. It's because of that I decided to pursue that as a general theoretical issue. More broadly in society. But the issue of having a canon is actually a way of solving an overload problem. Easiest way to think about that is, you know, with respect to like my own discipline would be, why is it that all sociologists, at least in the United States, read Marx, Weber, and Durkheim? And a few of them read a little Zimmel, but nobody reads much Gabriel Taub. Nobody reads Ludwig Gumplowitz. Nobody reads Gustav Rassenhofer. Nobody reads Rudolf von Jhering. In other words, the list of social theorists we don't read is very, very long. Well, why is that? It's because if some sociologists read one of those guys and some other sociologists read some other of those guys, they'd get together and they'd want to talk about, I don't know what, legitimacy. And the ones who'd read Weber would say, well, legitimacy is blah, blah, blah. And the ones who'd read Rassenhofer would say, legitimacy is something else and so on. They wouldn't have a common language. So the purpose in some sense of a canon is to take a situation of complete overload, make a fairly arbitrary selection in it and say, okay, we're all going to read these guys. That way we'll have something to say when we get together. So on this argument, you know, canons aren't so much about excluding people or something like that. They're really about solving a problem of too muchness. And so giving us something to talk about. So the way to think about that more broadly in academic knowledge is that actual disciplinary canons are not so much about keeping people out of our discipline because they haven't read X, Y, Z, but making it so that at least the people in the discipline have kind of all read the same things and we can at least have something to talk about rather than saying, well, my guy said so-and-so and somebody else said, so my guy said such-and-such. I mean, you see this, you know, it's like the critical realist. They read Roy Boschkar and, you know, that's it. And so if you haven't read Roy Boschkar, you can't talk to these people. but it hasn't been decided that what they're trying to do, of course, is to get him into the canon of things that everybody has to read. But of course, to do that, they have to kick somebody else out. So I think that, you know, the sort of old style of memorization, the way to think about it is it was actually central to the maintenance of certain kinds of social elites. Because, you know, those guys in Parliament may have disagreed about everything, but they could quote, you know, Horace and Juvenal and so on to each other in Latin on the floor of Commons, and everybody knew what the joke was because they'd all gone to Oxford and read the same damn stuff. So what it provided was a common language that they had, and of course that nobody else had. So there is an exclusionary quality to it there, but it's quite possible to envision canon as mainly organized for the purpose of dealing with the incredible vast array of stuff. So canon is one of the ways in the past that we have dealt with overload a la internet. That's the way to think of it, because I'm trying right now to come up with various models of this. Simplification is one of the other ones, or development of reference words. So you might think Wikipedia is like brand new. But of course, it turns out there have been books like this, books that were the equivalent of it, for hundreds of years. There are books that were typically made by Victorian clergymen who had lots of time on their hands and just wrote down every little thing they could remember about anything. Most of these books that we reference books we have now, like the Reader's Encyclopedia, for example, has its origin about 130 years before, in the early to middle 19th century, in the work of some Victorian clergyman who just made a list of all the possible allusions you could possibly be interested in. So there always have been these kinds of simplification devices before, and it's not clear that the quality control in those things was all that much greater than the quality control of Wikipedia, which is pretty poor. But at least by establishing, you know, a single list of things, this is the list, you know, it's to some extent it helps by simplifying stuff, it kind of helps the task of knowledge. That's kind of a long answer to the question about memorization, but I think you have to think about memorization in the context of this problem, this huge problem of overload that we all face all the time, and that has been true for certainly since the existence of the book.
Mm-hmm. So now we've discussed reading and now just memorization, and of course the only... Well, not the only reason, but at least part of the reason that researchers and students, you know, partake in these activities is to, at some point, turn it into words, into an argument, into a paper. So how does, I'm assuming, I mean, writing kind of follows as a natural corollary to this. If we're not reading as well as we should, if we're not memorizing, at least up to kind of these theoretical potential marks of yesterday, then surely the writing is suffering too. Is that safe to say as a relationship between those two or three things?
There are a lot of different reasons behind why writing is suffering. So one of the reasons that it's suffering is simply the fact that the bean counters in the dean's offices want tons and tons of articles, and so people are writing tons and tons of articles that they never would have bothered to write before. It's important to realize that the modal number of papers written in a lifetime by a PhD in American academia as of the middle 20th century was probably one or two. So these people wrote a dissertation, which in those days sometimes had to be published, but often was just published in a monograph series that existed just for the purpose of publishing dissertations. So I think the first thing you have to realize is that historically, the notion that everyone who reads works carefully, reflects work carefully about works, does research, the notion that that person is always going to write something is worrisome. One of the things that lots of those people did, you know, even 50 years ago, much less 80, is they taught people. So if you were to look at the majority of Oxford dons in the early 20th century, you discover that most of them had never actually published much. But they spent a whole lot of time teaching tutorial classes and giving lectures in the schools and so on. They spent a lot of time teaching. They spent a lot of time reading student essays and commenting on them. Some of them spent a lot of time writing as well. C.S. Lewis, for example, a person who was a tutorial fellow, saw tons and tons of students, corrected lots of student papers, but also wrote a great deal. But there are plenty of other people that you haven't heard of who didn't do that, who didn't write much. Well, nowadays we have these bean counters, and so everybody's writing stuff, including, you know, third and fourth year graduate students who actually have nothing more to say than I had when I was a third or fourth year graduate student, which is probably not much. So much of the sort of emphasis on writing is purposeless writing that exists mainly for the purpose of personnel advancement. And a whole separate argument, which I don't want to get into, is that basically our scholarly communication system is being killed by the fact that it's mainly now an evaluation system, not a communication system. So there's too much stuff. It's harder and harder to find the stuff that's really good. And so people are much less likely to read because it's so much work to find anything that's worth reading. So that's a whole separate kind of, another reason why the world's going to hell in a handbasket. So I think that that's one of the things that's happening to writing. Now, another thing that's happening to writing is that, again, this is a place where you really see the differences between secondary education systems that have a lot of money and secondary education systems that don't. Of course, I'm in the United States where there's a huge variety, much larger variety in secondary education than there is in a place like Great Britain or France, where the curricula are really much more centrally designed. But here in the U.S., it's possible, here in the Chicago area, for example, we have communities are funding their education basically off local taxes. And we have communities, there's a ratio of 1 to 5 between the communities in the Chicago region with the lowest amount of tax dollars per student and the communities with the most. Literally, that's the difference. So the state makes up some of that difference, but it's still a case that for students who've gone to the really prominent North Shore high schools north of Chicago, for the students who've gone to the elite prep schools throughout the United States, I can tell those students in class by their writing in 5 minutes because they have been taught how to write. They may not have much to say, but they do know how to construct a sentence. They know how to make a paragraph that has internal sense. They know how to do this. The students who have not had the same kind of teachers that those students, those privileged students have had, have much weaker writing skills. Now, so that's part of what we see is just that some of the secondary education system just doesn't have the money to hire enough teachers to do this, and maybe enough to hire enough good teachers to do this. There's also a bigger change, though, which is tied up with the internet. As you probably know, if you go to any internet web development site, it will tell you that the level of language to use on an internet site is maximum optimized at about 6th grade. So that's about 14, at the age you would be at 12, 13. So internet sites tend to use really dumb language. Really, it's just, I mean, by the point, when you're looking at it, from the point I am at an elite institution at the very top of the food chain, it's unbelievably dumb writing. But that's what they're contacting day after day after day as they cruise around the internet. That is one thing they're contacting. The other thing they're contacting is their own friends' posts and blogs, and which are just sort of, flabby, flatulent prose. Just blah, blah, blah. And, I did so-and-so, and whatever. Like, he was really out there, this is not prose. This is gibberish. So one of the problems is that the students, even the best students and the students with a great deal of training, simply have not contacted as much good prose as any of us did when we were kids. And that's, again, not because we were wonderful and we read only, Edith Wharton and so on. It's because all there was for us to do was read. Television was just coming in, and, our parents wouldn't let us watch that much television anyway.
Right.
So you read a lot of stuff. You really got used to the language. You used the language all the time. Even the best of students today have much less exposure to prose than they had before. So in general, when I'm teaching students how to write, the first thing I do is make them start reading good prose because they haven't read that much. 50 or 60 years ago, you grew up in an environment of good prose. People were really focused on it. So I think at this point, you write what you read. And if the real problem, the first main problem in writing is that students don't have a sense of what they should be reading. So that's typically when I teach writing courses, I start by making them read stuff and making them imitate styles because it just makes them aware of, you know, there's a way to write sentences, and there are different ways to write sentences for different purposes. They just don't have a sense of that. And the reality is very few of them are going to have to write anything important in their lives. That's just a fact. You know, the big law reports, the legal cases will be written by committees, and there'll be somebody there who's a good writer. The people who are going to become physicians, they're never going to need to know how to write. The people who become businessmen, forget it. What they need to, those people need to know is, you know, how to make clever bullet points and PowerPoints to persuade people of stuff that's wrong and all that kind of stuff. You know, writing is not a skill they're going to need. Now, the sad thing is, you know, it's also the academics, however, the potential academics who get children, and they really need to be taught how to write because they haven't been pushed in that direction. So, you know, there are some of them. There, obviously, the people who are going to become academics are more likely to have read a lot of print. They're better off, but it's still different from the situation that we were in, I think.
You have this this idea of kind of controlled vocabulary, which you talked about in your book, and you talk about, you know, the need to identify 20 or so central kind of concepts or phenomena in your study, and then kind of create fixed definitions. Could you just talk us through a little bit about that idea? Why, as researchers, why are we doing this? Is it just to be rigorous? And how does it kind of affect the quality of what we're striving towards?
Well, the central thing that it does is that it means you kind of tie down your argument to a set of relatively fixed definitions. And, you know, obviously that the reason for doing that has to do with a certain kind of ideal of how an argument should be organized, what the best way is to make an argument. And, you know, I think that the concept of controlled vocabulary comes from the library literature. That's how classical indexes were done, with a fixed vocabulary so that everyone would kind of know what was referring to what. And there are strengths of that and there are weaknesses of that. The strength, obviously, is that you have got common agreement. The weakness is that it suppresses certain kinds of ambiguity and it makes certain kinds of change hard to recognize. That's been known in the library and indexing literature for a long time. But I think, you know, as an ideal for research project, what I'm really emphasizing there is that most students do not come into a major research project in the humanities and social sciences with a notion that it kind of has to have a pretty tight logical organization, and that needs to include fairly tight definitions of the major terms, conceptions of the major social groups. Because if you don't do that, accidental changes and things are going to be imported in through different meanings. And if you don't make those things explicit, then readers who have different meanings for some of the words you use will put their own content into your prose. Now, obviously, you know, it's not going to turn out that you write some kind of project as math proof, but it's the notion of controlled vocabulary is the notion that you'd rather try to err on that side, being too specific and maybe have underachieved and been a little looser, rather than not trying at all to be in some sense, you know, clear and explicit. You need to aim high, and then you'll hit the average, because if you just aim at getting the average right, it's just not going to work. Students uniformly in my classes have really liked the exercise of forcing themselves to develop a controlled vocabulary. It turns out that actually that is part of what they used to think was necessary to writing. And by making it come earlier in the project, you avoid the sort of panic at the last minute when you have to kind of make sense of all this stuff because you haven't been thinking about it in a disciplined way up to that point. So that's the idea. It's just one of many ongoing disciplines to try to keep your study together and logical and well-defined so that you don't have to somehow at the end put it all together in some magical way.
Mm-hmm. Alex and I both highlighted a section of your book, and we read the book separately and thoroughly enjoyed it. But and it was about the concept of the unfinishability of research. You wrote here, video games have levels and have ends, but there is no end to research. There are always new things to study, new issues to clarify, new sub-questions to ask. Only your governing document contains a specific set of questions whose answer completes the project. In a separate part of your book, you wrote about how pursuing different leads of research, you know, when you're just looking to clarify a piece of information, can in fact lead to something entirely different. You wrote, "Divergent information often means divergent realities." You know, what's a major red flag for you in your work that you're starting to either pursue information that's not relevant to your thesis, or that you should just steer clear of entirely?
Well, I think it's pretty easy to give the answer to that. This is a piece of advice which I have given to, you know, what you're reading here. You know, there comes a time to not follow up, to shut off, just finish things. This is advice to give that I give to students, but it's not advice I'm very good at following myself. So the reality is that, I've sat in over 100 dissertation committees. I've watched a lot of students come close to getting lost, and I know this is advice you need to give. My own work is full of examples where I haven't done this, where I've gone on to other stuff. My file cabinets here are full of uncompleted projects. I'm right now basically trying to finish off 6 different books. I've just, the one you've read is the first of them. The one I just sent off a month ago is the second. I'm also finishing this, pseudonymic book that I write, that's been writing in the AJS under the name Barbara Tellerent. And I've got also a theoretical treatise in 2 volumes and a book I'm writing on the future of knowledge. So I'm not a guy who's actually very good at things off, deciding they're done, out the door. Now I've reached an age where, I'm going to be sent out the door feet first pretty soon, and that means they've got to be finished. So I'm sort of at a different place on this. I have real difficulty with this. I have difficulty with even writing a single paper at an extremely consistent tone level. Because I'm given to putting in wise-ass remarks or making deft references to something that's far off. I mean, I myself often violate a lot of the rules that are good rules. maybe that's a way of saying, then just because I'm who I am, people say, oh, he's very creative or something like that. But actually, it's just I'm kind of a little out of control. one way to think about my whole career is that, when I was younger, people thought I was a flake. They expected me, and in fact, my dissertation at University of Chicago, right here. In fact, I'm sitting in my dissertation advisor's chair in his office, because that's now my office. He thought my dissertation was completely out of control, that it was much too large, many too many different parts. 600 pages. I never published my dissertation. It's just a complete study of everything you could imagine about American psychiatry between 1880 and 1930. And in some ways, you could think that this advice was advice that I wish I had had. But on the other hand, my dissertation has proved to be a source of lots of ideas and puzzles and problems and that kind of stuff. So I know this is advice that many students need. And I also know it's advice that I'm not terribly good with myself.
There's a distinction which some people like to draw between kind of pure research, let's say, as perhaps practiced in the academy as kind of traditionally defined, and more practically focused research, you know, perhaps we're talking about think tanks and so on, where the idea is to find ideas that can be instrumentalized in some way or can be put into practice in some way in policy, let's say. And I know there are all sorts of kind of different strands that we could kind of come at this. I guess, do you see there being this kind of strong distinction? Does it make too much difference in terms of how one goes about research?
I think it makes fundamental difference in how you go about research. And deep down, I myself have never been much interested in applied knowledge at all. I know there are wonderful people in the world who do wonderful applied research in the social sciences, even in the humanities, that it's very useful for some purposes. I think, you know, the modern social system is so productive in terms of its ability to generate useful and wonderful things to enable people to have good lives, that this society could afford to have huge proportions of its members dedicate large portions of their lives to doing research that has absolutely no practical implications whatsoever. But that might be purely interesting from the point of view of understanding human nature, or might be beautiful aesthetically, who knows what. We have an absolutely, you know, Keynes said this many years ago, we have an extremely productive system. There's absolutely no need for any of us to work anywhere near as hard as we do. We have a system that could easily feed and clothe and take care of everyone on this planet if distribution were more sensible. And so we ought to be able to afford a huge amount of knowledge for its own sake. As it happens, we don't have that. And I, you know, obviously lots and lots of research. It's useful to have research dedicated to why that is happening and this sort of thing. I do think that much of the policy research ends up being driven by the policies that are under, by the politics that are underneath it. And that, I guess what has happened to me in sociology is that I've watched what a lot of my colleagues think of as the politicization of sociology over the last 40 years in the U.S. If you were to look at the sociology journals, over half the articles in them have the subject inequality in them. It's probably not the case that inequality is worth more than 50% of the inquiry that we do into social life. But that's what happens. I mean, that basically the disciplines have been taken over by this kind of social democratic project, and that's okay. I think for me, the broader picture is not just about the importance of knowledge for itself, but is about the fact that we are at a very rare moment in the history of the social sciences, I guess is the way to put it.
Right.
So the social sciences grew up at the end of the 19th century, and both in the United States and in Europe, they were basically concerned with the project of understanding modern society. In Europe, that's very much in context of from traditional to modern. What does this mean? What is the modern? What's it like? And so on. You have Weber's take, Durkheim's take, Marx's take, all these different people trying to understand what has happened. In the United States, because the United States doesn't have that kind of a traditional basis, but was a country which, as of the mid and late 19th century, was basically focused on migration and on the coming together of enormously diverse groups of people in not very highly controlled social environments. In America, the inquiry into modernity takes the shape of the Chicago School. It's much more about variety and interaction and process and all this other stuff, because that's the big issue here. But the issue is that that generation, which really built the social sciences, the issues that it was built on were kind of issues that had to do with thinking about whole societies and about the nature of society, how it was changing. It kind of, much of it framed in nationalism. because of the enlistment of the discipline of history in the service of nationalism at the end of the 19th century. We're now in a world in which that kind of, that particular brand of nationalism is kind of coming apart. You could argue that we're in a world which has gone back to a much more natural state, in which the national boundaries are not all that sharp. There's a lot of products and people and so on wandering back and forth between them. And I think for me, the central issue of the social sciences going forward is going to be a somewhat different one. Because the social science, where the social sciences have ended up focusing, as of the second half of the 20th, the beginning of the 21st century, is on issues of inequality, inclusion, and so on. They're very much framed within the liberal contractarian political tradition. They conceive of a single individual as the unit of society, possibly aggregated into classes, as in Marx. But the criterion that they see for society is, as in Marx and all of his inheritors, is inclusion of a certain class in the body of society. And I think it'll turn out to be very significant that Marx was unable to conceive of what the social process would look like after the proletarian revolution. Because once this issue of inclusion is resolved and everybody's kind of the same, it's not clear to what else there is for humanity to do. Mm-hmm. I think the situation we face right now is that this ideal of a liberal society in which there's a very small body of stuff which everybody has in common, and then there's all this variety and difference and so on and so forth, that is other stuff but isn't somehow allowed to affect this core of equality. That model of the world is not necessarily shared by the rest of the world. In particular, the way of thinking about social life that's characteristic of liberalism does not appear to me to be very, what should we say, conformable with Islam. Islam itself is a religion that's really organized around a social set of social disciplines. The Quran consists mainly of things you should do, rules of behavior. It's not a bunch of histories and so on. And the focus of the Islamic tradition as it's evolved has been really the great legal traditions, the four great legal traditions, and their different inquiries into how social life should be organized. In a certain sense, when I set out to write the Barbara series, I didn't realize how much difficulty I would have finding important works of sociology from Islamic countries. One of the reasons for that, I think, is that to a considerable extent, Islam is its own sociology. It is a theory of society. I also think that it's not at all clear to me that the Chinese in the long run will take up the liberal idea of society, the liberal concept of the social polity that's standard since the Western contractarian tradition. And I think the issue is that the social sciences, for the most part, are pretty firmly identified with the liberal tradition. That certainly is the way most of the instrumentalist and interventionist approaches to social science have been voiced. They've been voiced in terms of social democracy, in terms of membership, inclusion, all these kinds of things, which are very much, you conceive of the world as individuals organized into a society a la Rousseau, a la Hobbes, Locke, really. I'm not sure that whole body of normative social thought is really conformable with some of the great normative traditions elsewhere in the world. And so I think the great task of the social sciences intellectually at this particular moment is going to be to confront that issue and to think about kinds of sociology that might, or social science that might, how shall I say, that might, French would say abordé, come next to, begin to take on, begin to recognize, begin to work with this fact that the normative grounds of social life are not the same everywhere in the world. And now, of course, we have, international legal institutions, which are based, I think, again, largely on this normative tradition.
it's not sure how efficacious those things actually are. I guess for me, the big issue, the issue of the sort of normative and interventionist side is that I think that the normative and interventionist side of the social sciences, in the first place, it's always been mainly implicit. The only place where it's explicitly followed is in the dismal political theory in political science. So there you do have people inquiring about, you know, what's political theories, but it's important to recognize that basically political theory as a discipline is pretty much about ringing the changes on the liberal contractarian idea of society, and also on the ontology, the social ontology that's imagined underneath that. And I think both that ontology and that body of normative thinking are not necessarily shared throughout the world. And that means that the social sciences face a kind of, in my view, a kind of normative crisis. My own sense is, obviously I'm writing a paper on this or I wouldn't be reciting this argument so easily. My own sense is that we have to found a serious normative subdiscipline for the social sciences that's much broader than political theory and that pays much more attention to realistic concepts of social ontology. Because one of the ways in which there's social difference that the liberal tradition never thought about is that people change a great deal over their life cycles. And it's possible for people to be, privileged at one portion of their life cycle and unprivileged at another portion. It's possible for people to change. It's possible for people to have direction. What are the good ways for that to happen? Should we even be thinking about goodness in social life predominantly in terms of the sum of the experience of individuals? I think we're at a moment where actually pretty fundamental normative questions are going to be up for grabs. That place where you see that in practice, of course, is in, you know, looking at international non-governmental organizations, INGOs, and the way they are treated and in some ways gamed by the rest of the world. Same thing for international legal institutions, but also for differences in international commercial life. And, you know, capitalism itself has had to deal with a lot of this stuff for a while. And it's not at all clear that the rules of capitalism in different parts of the world are going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a long answer.
Well, with that, we want to be respectful of your time, and we're watching the clock here. You'd mentioned earlier that you're working on a book on the future of knowledge, and perhaps it's a good segue from your comments just now. I'll ask a huge open-ended question, and feel free to say, you know, read the book if we're out of time. But what is the future of knowledge?
Well, it's quite easy. The future of knowledge is going to be what we make of it. I'm a pragmatist, and there isn't a future of knowledge that's out there to be discovered on the internet or by some predictive something or other. The future of knowledge is going to be what we do to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's performative. And so if we allow the future, if we say, oh, these horrible things are coming, if we pretend like we're Marx, oh, there's just this grand social forces and there are huge social forces and there's no way to avoid them and blah, 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 blah. No, we're dead. The whole thing's over. But, you know, that's not the way I think the world is. The world doesn't have that ontology. That's exactly the point. Marxian ontology doesn't permit, you know, it creates this absurd problem of structure and agency. Well, over here in the pragmatist tradition, we don't have that problem. We have other problems. We don't have that one. So that's the answer. The future of knowledge is what we are going to make of it. And what I'm going to do is, you know, write the books I can, and then I'll die, and other people will take up the task, and we'll see what happens.
Amazing. Dr. Abbott, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. It was a true pleasure.
Sure. Thanks very much.
For our listeners, if you heard a reference to something, a book or a website or an article, the full show notes with links to everything we've discussed in the show can be found at sourcesandmethods.com. If you enjoyed what you heard this week and in previous episodes, please consider writing a review of the show in iTunes or just recommend it to a friend on Twitter or maybe even in real life. Thanks for listening.